succession number 22246, reel 1.
Do you remember when you first joined up, what year it was?
Yes, it was halfway through 1942.
Right,
slightly under it.
When you joined up, what did you actually join?
I joined the 70th Battalion Royal Sussex Regiment. In fact, we started off at Brock Barracks in Reading, and from Reading, after 6 weeks preliminary training, we were stationed at Colchester in Essex. And from there we did the carrier course, that's learning to drive on guide trucks and bring in carriers, and then a 3-inch mortar course. And from there I was posted, in fact, to the 70th Battalion Royal Sussex Regiment, stationed at Caterham in civilian billets there. We did an awful lot of sort of normal training, that sort of thing. And it was one day, in fact, we were there and we had people visiting us from the parachute regiment. After recruits, of course, there was about 20 of us volunteered.
Yes.
We were then seen off by the RSM ward at Caterham. I always remember him saying, well, I shall see half of you blighters back within 7 days.
Can I ask you why you volunteered? You for the parachute?
Well, I think possibly. I mean, there's a sort of hidden something there that I, you know, these days I'm going to be sort of dead hair and scare him, etc.
Yes.
You know, that sort of something added to it, you know, that. Something out of the ordinary, shall I say that? Probably Death and Glory Boys, I don't know. However, we didn't sort of return. We went up to Hardwick Hall for the first 3 weeks of the hardening and toughening up course, etc. And after, you know, all the assault courses, going under fire, PT and respirators and that type of thing, we went on as guests of the RAF at Ringway Airport. And from there, of course, we were put into billets. And then we sort of saw the preliminary sort of parachuting, etc., and put into syndicates, etc., as they call us. And we were then taken out to Tatton Park, which is the dropping zone there, to witness the preceding course, in fact, completing their drops. It was on there, and I saw one Roman candle, which in fact meant that the chute didn't fully develop, you see. And this sort of put the wind up us all a little bit. However, we completed our training, and from Ringway we used to come to, from Ringway we take off, drop at Tatton Park. But first we started off with two balloon drops from 800 feet. It was five in a cage with a whole aperture in the centre. Now it used to go. There was one night drop from balloon, and we started off with five aircraft drops, which in fact were made up of slow pairs first. Then stick of five with containers going out between the 10 men in the aircraft, and on to virtually the mass drop when we passed out and got our wings after about fortnight.
Mm. These would all be static, what they call static line.
Oh yes, yes,
mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm. A status chute, in fact, is entirely different from a parachute. Well,
what was the minimum sort of height that you can jump with one of those?
700.
Yeah.
Well, actually, in action, you come down possibly with an aircraft flying and decreasing in height the whole time, throttling back. You would possibly find that you'd come down to possibly the operational height of about 450, but nothing lower than that. You couldn't possibly sort of expect to do all you had to do and get away with it.
Was the training particularly tough?
Well, very much so,
yes.
Definitely.
In what way? I mean, what sort of things were you doing then?
Well, the hardening up course and the assault courses and that sort of thing, which was virtually commando training right the way through, you see.
Yes.
Everything, unarmed combat, boxing, wrestling, you virtually did the whole thing, you see.
What were your feelings when you did your first jump? Do you remember it?
Awfully scared, no. Yeah. Possibly the second jump was worse than the first, because you sort of half knew what to expect and you didn't sort of really know what was going to happen. I think possibly the night drop, the first night drop I did, was the most terrifying for a start, but the best landing I ever had, I think, in the whole career.
Yeah.
From the static room.
I mean, even after the first drop, your first jump, you still felt sort of apprehensive?
Oh, yes, I didn't used to
parachute. Never wore, it never became that familiar that...
Oh, no, I mean, you didn't care, virtually. I mean, admittedly, but there's sometimes there that you did feel awfully scared. It all depends as to what the weather conditions were and what had happened prior to sort of taking off, you know, whether you had a lot of trouble on the planing and that sort of thing. But, of course, in the old Whitley drops, they were sort of, you know, pretty rugged in that time. There's always a job you had to make certain you got out of the aperture right, you see. I mean, if you didn't, sort of rang the bell as we turned it the other side and put your teeth through your lip or something, or bang your helmet. Mm-hmm. And of course that did result in somersaulting through the rigging lines.
Yes. Yeah, but what happened after you'd completed your training?
Well, just prior to our passing out parade, when we were presented with our wings, and it's more or less the same sort of thing as an RAF pilot gets. We had this selection committee come up from Bulford after recruits for the 9th Para Battalion. They were interviewed again, etc. This incorporated an interesting talk with a psychiatrist as to why we wanted to join, etc. And eventually we were posted to the 9th Para Battalion. This was the whole syndicate, in fact, which were mostly infantry, of course, at those times.
What year was this, actually?
This would be 43. Possibly about September 43. From then we trained up ready for D-Day, etc. This meant forced road runs and walks and 50-mile marches, large schemes that would possibly take a week to 10 days to be away from camp.
Where were you stationed then?
We were actually based
at
Bulford on Salisbury Plain. Yes. Kiwi Block, or Sandhurst Block, Kiwi Barracks. It was just the 9th Para Battalion there, 3rd Para Brigade, and the whole of the 6th Airborne Division of the air landing grades and that sort of thing were posted very, very near to us, within the area, in fact. We used to sort of drop from Balloon virtually every other weekend. The 36-hour pass was promised us, and it was up to go in the balloon, do a couple of drops, way on 36-hour leave. We then graduated to aircraft from there. We used to use Dakotas quite a lot. The Yanks used to fly us a lot. The RAF used to fly us a lot. And prior to D-Day, I mean, this training up business, we used to getting wagons. I mean, the whole division used to be sort of put into 3-ton trucks, the back covered down. We had no idea which airfield we were going to. Possibly we'd be driven for 50 or 60 miles to an airfield. No idea where it was at all. Be draw our parachutes, kitted up, etc. Emplaned, fly it over the channel, turn back again, drop somewhere in England virtually. It was mostly we do in Oxfordshire, where the RAs built us the exact replica of the actual gun battery we attacked at D-Day, which is at Melville on the Normandy coast. Mm-hmm. One of these cross-channel gun bases, you know. We were trained very highly for this, and in fact, as I mentioned, the RAs did build us this exact replica of the actual gun battery. Of course, nothing actually ever worked out as it did in training, but that was the whole idea of it.
Were there any incidents that come to your mind there that you particularly recall during training?
During training? Oh, plenty. I think one of the worst ones, in fact, was we used to blow the Dannett wire with Bangalore torpedoes. These were actually sort of 6-foot lengths of drain pipe packed with high explosive. It's gun cotton charges in the end. And actually used to threadle them through the Dannett wire, locking with a bayonet type locking device, push one length through, lock the next length onto that, push that through. And of course we were attacking this made up battery virtually at all hours of the day and night. I mean, we'd have an approach march, and us in B Company, in fact, with a mine clearing party through the minefield first, taping, and I was with the Bangalore torpedo party, in fact, for blowing the Dannett wire for main C Company's assault troops coming through our lines before going down the anti-tank ditch and into the gun battery, you see. And of course, I was wireless operator at this time. and some clot. This was actual HE we were using. Some clot, of course, put the order blow through, where we were still connecting our Bangor torpedoes on that particular party. Well, either side of us, possibly about 50 yards either side of us, blew, and we were still there, and all virtually blown all over the place, you know, and wrecked the radio and couldn't stand as well. But none of us were wounded, actually. We got away with it, and that was actually just in training.
Yes.
So you can imagine, it was all live ammo and that sort of
thing.
But it was well worth it, I think, quite honestly, because although when D-Day came, it never sort of worked out. We sort of had to rough out exactly what was going to happen. I mean,
did you know at this time that this was, you know, going to be your particular part?
We knew it was going to be our objective, yes, definitely. We'd seen actual aerial photographs, and of course the briefing used to go through is exactly the same as an aircrew used to go through.
Yes. But you wouldn't have known where particularly?
No, we didn't know where, of course. No. We knew it was a cross-channel battery we were going to attack. That's our particular battalion. We knew it would come at D-Day, or Invasion Day, as it termed it then. But, of course, we'd no idea exactly where the battery was. We knew it was called Melville, and we'd seen aerial photographs, but what part of the coast it was, we didn't know. But there was no getting away from it. This build-up that the RAs had given us was pretty good, really. I mean, it was exact to scale right the way through. And the only thing that weren't in position were the actual guns. It's difficult, sort of looking back on those days, really, to remember all that happened on training. I mean, all sorts of things. I mean, the actual drop in the approach march. I mean, that drop, you could sort of get tangled up in rigging lines, sort of land virtually upside down, you get twists out of an aircraft. We were absolutely loaded to the hilt with equipment. So when we first started dropping with our own weapons, we didn't use containers dropped out between the sticks from aircraft. We used to drop with our own weapons. Even stretcher bearers had their own stretchers. Chappies with bicycles sort of strapped to them. Our own war dogs, we had two Alsatian dogs in the battalion, they went out with their masters. And of course, they'd actually jump behind the masters. They were so trained, in fact, they'd jump behind shirts. It was almost interesting, really. I mean, but being a youngster, you never appreciated it was history being made, possibly, at that time. You know, you never even thought, well, you may live through it. I never did. Never really got used to it. However, from the time we actually left Bulford, and then prior to D-Day, and we didn't know when this was actually going to happen, we were put into I forget the term, but it was a closed camp somewhere up in the Oxfordshire area. The whole 6th Airborne Div was deployed over an area, and we were, as I say, in the 3rd Para Brigade. That was comprised of the 9th Para Battalion, the 8th Para Battalion, and the 1st Canadian Para Battalion. It was quite interesting, actually. The 1st Canadian Para Battalion was the only battalion that Canadians had as parachute troops. They were in their actual brigade. A jolly nice lot, too. We were put into this, as I say, we were put into this camp, where in fact it was a closed camp prior to D-Day. We had no idea, in fact, when this was going to happen, but we knew sometime. Well, when the order in a flap-on came through, we were put into three-ton wagons once again, flown to an airfield, kitted up. By this time we were ammoed up, live ammunition, May West flying over the water, and virtually out to deployment areas where we actually stayed with the aircraft. And we emplaned, in fact, somewhere about 3 o'clock in the morning, if I remember correctly, and dropped about 5. That's before the main assault came in. We had, actually with our battalion, we had two supposedly glider-borne parties crash-landing on the battery prior to us dropping on their approach march. This was returned as Captain Gordon Brown's party. The idea being, in fact, that I think two sections from A Company had volunteered to be glider-borne troops for this particular day, although they were paras officially, they were glider-borne troops. It's rather strange, actually, we didn't know this until afterwards, that one glider cast loose over the channel and landed back in England here. All the lads got out a bit smarter and, of course, thought they were in France, not knowing any differently. Anyway, they soon put that one right. Came out again afterwards, actually, joined us out there. The second one actually crash landed, fired from the background. There's just no point in doing it at all. Mm. Just hopeless. I mean, whether they cast loose too early, we never knew. The actual drop itself wasn't too bad. We had a lot of firing, small arms firing, that sort of thing. Major Bestia, our company commander, was shot badly through the legs. I think both his legs were amputated. I never actually saw him from that day to this. Various different chaps were sort of shot up here and there.
What was the light? What were the light conditions like in the weather at the time?
Well, it was in a very, very early morning. Just sort of getting daylight, virtually. There's a lot of small arms fire there on the dropping zone.
Were the aircraft attacked on the way in?
Not by fighters at all, but we had fighter escort. But I never sort of saw very much. I mean, we were so busy in the plane. There's an awful lot to do before you actually got out. I mean, you get the order, stand up, hook up, check equipment. That is where number 20 in the stick, that's the first chap, at least the last chap up behind the wireless operator's compartment. The wireless operator checks number 20. Number 20 checks number 19, and so forth, right to the end of the stick. And you get reported to the actual dispatcher, as we termed him, that stick okay. Well, number one okay, stick okay. Then you get flying in, which in fact, when the pilot sort of sees the marker actually on the D's end, and these are always marked by a Pathfinder party virtually, you get stand to the door. Well, of course, a stand to the door could be 2 or 3 minutes, it seems like hours virtually, if you're number one. You're sort of looking up, your braces are ready for dispatching, and you get the red light on, and then 2 or 3 seconds, usually a green. This dispatching always happens so quickly that you're on top of the chap's shoulders in front of you before you realise it. I mean, you just sort of see a gaping hole, rush of air, feet and knees together, grab all your equipment.
This is out of the side of the aircraft,
yes,
is it?
And that's from the Dakota. We use Dakotas actually on there. Yes, so different from the Whitley, which were aperture drops. Mm-hmm. Halifax was aperture drop. The C-82, the American twin boom kite, in fact, that carried 40 troops. Dakota 20, Whitley 10, Wellington 10, Halifax. I forget now the actual number. The Halifax. We used all of those, in fact, for dropping. And Stirlings for pull-off drops. We did experimental work on those. That was from the back of the aircraft. Mm. But weren't successful.
Mm-hmm. What do you remember of your own particular drop on this, on D-Day? Do you recall it at all?
Rather scared, down? Shall we say. Loaded up to the hilt with a wireless set.
What did you see beneath you?
It was quite a good landing, actually. I think I came down a bit of a bush, I think, if I remember correctly. Dropping zone sort of varied, you know, that you can hardly sort of remember what it is. I remember landing in a potato field once. It's about what was the softest landing I think I ever had, apart from the night drop. We attacked the gun battery, and of course, we went in, I think it was about 180 men. The 9th Power Battalion out of 900 that actually reached the actual gun battery itself. They were dropped over a wide area. There was no getting away from that.
Were you given long to sort of form up or whatever you had to do?
You see, when you get onto the dropping zone, actually land, you go to an RV point. You rendezvous at a certain point, prearranged on the map. You all make for this point and form up. Then the companies are deployed out in platoon strength out and around the perimeter. In other words, you take defensive action directly in an RV area. And from then, orders go out that you actually form up for the approach march, which in this case, I think, was somewhere about a mile and a half, 2 miles, in fact, marched that particular night, or early morning.
Yes. And how did things go from your own point of view, then?
Pretty good, actually. I thought I was one of the lucky ones on that particular operation. We were across there for some time, actually, and we were eventually drawn out and came back to Balfour, you know, on the sort of plane once again. reserve company were left, remnants of the actual 601 Div were still on the sorted plane, always an R company left there of each power battalion or each glide upon battalion right the way through. And then we're actually all set for Arnhem, in fact. When Arnhem came in September, we were standing by, expected to be called on any time at all, and they put the 1st Airborne Division in Arnhem. But they withdrew the troops out, as well we know it's history now.
Yes.
They drew the troops out from there after a heck of a battle. And we weren't called on at all. They were standing by the whole time, even kitted up and ammunitioned up the whole time, actually waiting. We weren't called. Well, then came about that we were going to spend Christmas, that would be Christmas 44, in Bulford, in fact. There were no Christmas leave at all. I mean, it just was out of the question, things as it was, things as they were then. And it was actually Christmas morning we were called in at the Ardennes to. Now, we didn't do a drop on this at all. We went down to Amesbury Station. And we were actually marched. I think the whole battalion marched down there. The whole of the 601 Div went over in bits and pieces to Amesbury Station, in any case. And then we were taken down, if I remember rightly, to Southampton. From Southampton, we went across by sea and we landed, I think, somewhere Calais area. And I can't really remember exactly where it was. Anyway, we were met by transport there, and my own particular company, I was in, still B company, we were billeted in a place, oh dear dear, Tournai. We went in Tournai first, into a monastery, in fact. And it's rather surprising here, we had one of our chaps actually shoot himself with a 4.5 Colt revolver through the muscle of the leg, just couldn't take anymore. He'd been in action after D-Day and all the rest of it. And he went completely berserk, actually. I was in the same room when he did this. It shook everyone. Anyway, he was carted off. He never saw him that day. Someone was clearing brain gun. I nearly caught it. Actually, the bullet went straight between my feet and splinters of coconut matting and wooden flooring came up underneath my belly, and I nearly passed out. Well, I nearly had a lot there, of course. Anyway, that chappy was on a charge. It wasn't intentional, in fact, but complete accident, I hope. And from there, we really actually went first into the line, a place called Humane. We relieved the Yanks there. They were holding it from the Panzers, in fact. They were, you know, really had a bashing. There were Tiger tanks literally everywhere, just littered everywhere, dead bodies all the way around. And we had a little sort of house we took over as B Company headquarters, and from there we used to send out standing patrols and forward patrols from there. Of course, you can imagine what the snow was like. I never been so cold in all my life. We were melting down snow in mess tins to make tea with, and snow even to get a shave first thing in the morning. And I always remember going up to one of the forward positions, actually, from B Company headquarters. It was about 250, 300 yards. I had to go up this road, knocked out Tiger tanks either side, covered in snow, literally falling over everything there was around to fall over. And it was just about dark when I reached this forward position. When I saw how the chappies were doing up there, and I didn't bring a runner back with me at all, I sort of returned on my own. I thought, that's rather strange. That barn that I passed on my left going up should be on my right coming back. And lo and behold, it's still on my left. Well, that's rather strange. I bypassed the house. I mean, you can imagine, deep snow all the way around. Mm-hmm. I came across this notice, sort of looked round, Aptung Minen. I'd have been right there through the middle of a minefield and not even known it. It wasn't taped, you see. I was just dead lucky. I just got away with it. And the funniest part in that particular house, too, was at the Bangalore torpedo. The Bangalore torpedo, in fact, the German equivalent of whatever the name was, I don't know, but this house had been occupied by Americans prior to sort of taking it over as a billet and company headquarters. And someone had dug the usual sort of, well, it's not to say WC or bog, whatever you like to tell it, you can cut that one out if you like, in the back garden. Well, I was absolutely busting this particular morning and got onto this bar arrangement, just looked fetching, like an ordinary drain pipe between sort of two posts at the end, over this hole. And I happened to be sort of comfortably enjoying what I should have been enjoying, sort of looked around and suddenly realised it was a mine, a live Bangalore torpedo type of thing, you see, because I did shift very, very quickly. We blew that thing up, incidentally, as well. Mm. Mm. Strange. But from there, all sorts of action took place. We did forward patrols, standing patrols, fighting patrols, and that sort of thing, through the snow and snowsuits. All very interesting. And we were actually drawn out of there and went to a place called Banding, actually. Well, actually, the German panzers were in there at the time we went in. We captured the village. It's quite a large village. Captured the village from them. Drove them out to the woods overlooking the village, or outside the village town, whatever you like to term it. And we were surrounded by elderly folks sort of looking for their younger sons, and people looking for these young lads in the village of about 17, possibly under 16 and a half, 17. And they did say, in fact, that Christmas Eve they'd seen them, but hadn't seen anything of them since, and they wondered where on earth they could have gone to. Of course, we immediately put out a search party right the way through around the village, and we found them, actually, in the cellars of a cafe. Now, each one of these chappies, the poor souls, had been shot behind the ear and actually dropped into this cellar of the cafe, and they'd roughly sort of covered them over with straw and bits of railing and clothes and all the rest of it. Anyway, we were actually a burial party for these. We found these 32 blokes all shot, if you like. It's all youngsters. And it wasn't until I was in the Airborne Forces Museum the other day did I remember about this. In fact, the photograph is there as one of the pallbearers.
Did you ever know the reason for it?
No, it's just
a reprisal for
one of the apostles. Mm.
Yeah.
It was all very disturbing. And from there we went up to, I think it was Marsh, and then eventually into Holland. And this Holland episode is quite a thing.
It's the time we get too involved. Mm. I think we may have to change the tape over. Mm.
In Holland, and I forget the name of the extra large village we were in. It was right on the Maas opposite Roermond on the Dutch-German border, and from there Jerry had 88 OP observation posts, in fact, overlooking us. We in turn had our RA chaps attached to the 9th Parabattalion having their observation posts, in fact, overlooking the Germans, you see. Well, of course, this was sort of constantly being shelled the whole time. The first part, whilst I was there, was billeted in a very old castle with a moat around it. One particular day, we were sort of cleaning up between patrols, etc. Weapons and shaving, washing, cleaning up, washing socks, always needed washing. And Jerry opened up. We had the actual room I was in, the actual wall blown out. It was for there. One of the chaps was hurt, but I was dead fortunate. Pushed through a door on the other side. I was near the door at the time. It was just one of the things that happened. But from this particular village, we used to have to maintain a standing patrol to another smaller offshoot village, in fact, which meant wading through all the swirling water at night to get into position. And their orders were, in fact, to hold this village to the last man and to the last chimney pot, even as the water rose. We were to take to the roofs and hold this village. It was so important. Number 6 commander were quite close to us. But from this village, we had to go down on a 24-hour standing patrol. And the dress was actually optional on this, but it usually involved, if you start from the bottom, from PT shoes, the pumps, socks, if you wish, were unsocked.